thanks so much for being on again. That was a fantastic conversation. I appreciate all of your time. I was only planning on having you on for 45 minutes to an hour. I hate that we went so long, but I appreciate your being so generous with your time.
Well, that's what you get for talking to a former mime. You know, when you get an opportunity to talk, you just don't shut up. You want to hear a cool story? I got to share this with you because you would really appreciate this.
Oh, please.
Yeah, I'm part of this group called Masters of Horror. And yes. Mick Garris kind of put together all of us. So originally, it was literally like, you know, the apostles at the Last Supper, some of the pictures. I mean, but the, you know, it's like, you know, Rob Zombie, John Carpenter, Joe Dante, Wes Craven, Toby Hooper, John Landis, Bryan Singer. I mean, you know, it was just, you know, these guys. And somehow I got in there, you know, because of the Friday and my friendship with Mick and things. And then it just kept expanding and expanding and expanding until I think the last time, you know, there's like 44 guys there, you know, all the guys from Saw and all the more recent movies, and then going, you know, all the way back. And suddenly, maybe like 2, 3 years ago, 4 years ago, both Quentin and Robert started coming to these things. And the first time Quentin came, you know, and we were sitting at this table at this little place, he sat right next to me. And I was going, holy shit, you know, this is great. And at one point he turned to me and he says, I got to tell you about this new movie that we're going to do. And he pitched me Grindhouse. And he pitched shit that he didn't do. I mean, and, you know, how, you know, the commercials. And he went into Death Proof and he went into what Robert was going to do. And then, you know, at the end, there was going to be a guy that was going to come out and introduce, you know, if you guys would like to stick around, we're going to have like a new Swedish movie. You know, we're just going to be previewing it. And, you know, we hope you guys, you know, will hang in and watch this thing, you know. And it's like this softcore Swedish movie that was supposed to be this ludicrous thing that was going to, I can't remember how he was going to end it, but it sort of got interrupted by it getting the film breaking or something. I mean, he just had these incredibly crazy ideas, but the most amazing thing was to, you know, to be 2 feet away from him and to feel his energy in pitching something. I was ready to take out my credit card and just give it to him and say, let me invest. I mean, you could really see why this guy is who he is, because his passion and his ability, you know, to tell a story and tell a tale and reference other things and be right in your face and smiling, and you're smiling and nodding. You know, I was just amazed. And then at the end of the night, everybody was saying goodbye and stuff. And I was leaving, and, you know, and I see this, you know, vintage car, you know, that Quentin was driving, you know, take off down the alley. And I went, ah, shit. And I would have loved to just shake his hand, say goodbye again. And I'm walking towards my car, and then I hear this car back up. And, you know, and I turn around, and Quentin gets out of the car, and he comes over and he says, Tom, I just got to tell you, One Dark Night, Thorn, HBO, you know, and he starts naming off cast. He starts naming off TV episodes I did, you know, Date with an Angel. I mean, he was like a Rolodex of everything that I had done. And it's not because I'm anybody famous. It's because he's got a mind that's like that. He sees stuff and then it's like, you know, he's got this photographic, you know, memory. And I was like, you know this? He goes, yeah, man, it was great. I love that your shit. Yeah, I couldn't leave without telling you. Gets back in the car and takes off. And of course, you know, I was in hog heaven. I mean, I could not believe, you know, Quentin actually knew my shit, you know. But and he does that. I mean, when he talks about stuff, he just makes you feel like, you know, you are an equal and you love this stuff as much as he does. You know, it's infectious. It's just amazing. And Robert's very, very cool too. Much more chill, but also just very, you know, he knows his stuff and he's really, really all these horror guys. It's amazing that everybody's, you know, like a gentleman, really nice, really laid back. And of course the two energy guys are Quentin and John Landis. You know, those are the alpha dogs in the group. Yeah. You know, their voices pop through and above everybody else, you know.
You know, I was kind of amazed. I mean, I know that there was the Showtime show back in, was it 2005, 2006, Masters of Horror. But I would almost think it would be kind of amazing if somebody filmed the dinners and just the conversations in the back and forth. You know, not in like a larger version of the oh, was it the IFC John Favreau show? Was it Dinner for Five? Something like that. But, you know, instead do like a Masters of Horror show. I would kill to be a fly on that wall, you know?
I know everybody. It's like, I mean, you feel so lucky to be in that. And there was talks about that kind of thing, but I think everybody sort of felt like, well, this is sort of us celebrating us, and, you know, and people could be intimate, and those who drank, you know, would drink. And, you know, there was, but I mean, there was a exchanging of, you know, do you have this, you know, DVD of this? Oh, you got to see this, you know, and ideas. And the one cool thing which I got to share with you is one night we were all talking about stuff and somebody stood up and said, okay, what is the definitive horror movie that everybody got to say that when they saw it, it was like, this is the most horrific thing they ever saw.
Oh, wow.
You're not going to believe what the consensus was out of everybody. Once somebody started to bring it up and everybody agreed, Passion of the Christ.
Yeah, I can't argue with that.
You know, and I mean, I would have never thought that because, you know, I'm going Exorcist, you know, of course, you know, but when that started to come up and you go, yeah, I mean, that was intense, you know, and the, you know, the beating and what Mel did with that thing, it's like, yeah, that was pretty horrific.
I remember, you know, I was the big horror guy and, you know, at the theater when it came out, it wound up just being a small group of us of about four or five people. And I remember coming out of it feeling like I had been watching a horror film, like watching something like deeply upsetting and brutal and just and what was so crazy is we actually sold out the first 2 weeks. I had never seen another movie do that in all the time I was there. I worked there for 15 years and every single showing, I believe it was four or five showings a day for 2 weeks solid, sold out well in advance. And but this was like church groups and people bringing their children. And you know, I you would just watch all of these people, you know, from people in their 60s and 70s to young children that have been brought along for whatever reason, you know, just walking out shell-shocked and crying. And yeah, I can totally see that. I mean, you know, we don't really count that movie as a horror flick, I don't think. But as far as being one of the more brutal films out there, I mean, especially to have played like 2,500, 3,000 screens, something like that, I can't think of another movie that dealt in that level of gore and brutality. And yet it sort of, I think, gets a pass because it is, you know, because of the story that it tells.
Yeah, I know. It's amazing. You know, it's incredibly ballsy on his part, but I guess that's what that man is, you know, pretty much, you know, feels nobody can stop him. And he certainly made some mistakes, you know, but at the same time, my son just did a movie with him, the one that hasn't come out yet, where he's, I guess, a vigilante or something. I can't remember the name
of it. Is it Bloodfather or something like that?
Yes. That's okay. It. And I said, so what is he like? He said, he was the greatest. He just, you know, because my son's like a key PA, third assistant director. And he said, yeah, he treated us all really well. He was like funny and fun and, you know, just a great guy, incredibly professional and stuff. And it's like, well, you know, the image that, you know, is put out there is, you know, the drunk woman, you know, woman beater, whatever. I mean, it's amazing how, you know, you know, people are who they are. And then unfortunately, when their personal shit gets out there, it becomes a whole villain, you know, and then suddenly they'll do something and everybody forgets all that, you know. No, Michael Jackson never was with a child. No. You know, it's like all forgotten about, you know, quick, fast. But I was sort of, you know, because I've always been a fan of his. I've always loved how he'd take those characters, you know, way to the edge. Especially like with Lethal Weapon and stuff.
Oh, absolutely.
And then his, you know, just his own movies were always, you know, risk-taking.
Yeah, I think he's a hell of an artist. I mean, you know, it's weird to talk about him and be sort of a fan with it being public knowledge, you know, some of his, you know, the dodgier aspects of his personality. But it is, you know, you can tell that, you know, the man is an artist and he, you know, so he's wrestling with some demons. You know, I would hope that somebody like that can find a way to move past that or sort of, you know, get help. And I wonder if, I mean, it's certainly, it's very cool that, it sounds like he was, you know, a pleasure to work with. I wonder if he's taken steps in recent years to try and repair whatever it is that's perhaps, you know, wrong with him in a way.
Yeah. Yeah. Could be, you know, you hope, you know, because the main thing is obviously trying to find some sort of serenity about life and who you are and where you're at, you know, because it's a business that can really make you feel like you're invincible, and people do really act terrible at certain points in their career and then suddenly realize, you know, I'm not as hot as I thought I was. But you're made to feel that with, you know, managers, agents, lawyers, you know, press, everything, you know, you start to buy into this complete falsehood. And I've had so many actors that, you know, I saw were such sweet, wonderful innocents in the, you know, early days, and then suddenly become these egomaniacal guys or girls that just, like, you can't deal with them. I mean, they just, you know, I was watching like the cast of Glee, you know, just go from these wonderful, sweet, young, talented people to, no, I'm not coming out until she comes out, you know, of her trailer, and all those games and craziness.
Oh, wow.
But it's, you know, they're just, you know, they're young and don't know, you know, that it's, you know, it's, it takes a team, and, you know, you're only as hot as you are at that moment, and it's going to go away. Nothing stays, you know, there's going to constantly be that roller coaster.
Yeah, it is always interesting to watch that too, when there seems to be some sort of redemption, you know, that the press covers whenever somebody has had past mistakes and they sort of pull themselves up by the bootstraps or, you know, try and repair their image as best they can. It's always kind of fascinating to watch. But, you know, I'm maybe it's strange, but I always try my best not to let that affect my view of their work in a way. You know, for so many actors who have had, you know, really bad raps for their behavior, I mean, I can, well, I shouldn't say any names, but I'm a complete horror nerd, and I try and make the rounds at like any horror convention that, you know, comes around in the area. I actually met you at a horror convention at a Horror Hound a couple of years ago. And you were very nice to
me. Oh, did you?
Yeah. You were very nice to myself and my friend, but, there was a convention that I went to, and I met an actress who was, one of my heroes. She was in one of my favorite horror flicks ever. And it was kind of a big deal that she was there, and I met her, and she was just kind of terrible. And I was the entire time on the way back, you know, it was about a 2.5-3 hour long drive back home here. And I was like, God, what if this affects the movie? I was like, that will have been the worst thing ever. Like, I can handle having met her and her being kind of, you know, awful, but what if I pop this movie in and it's forever ruined? Unfortunately, I actually watched it that night. I popped the Blu-ray in, and 10 minutes in, I'm in love with that character, and, you know, I'm completely on her side. So, you know, but that's always kind of a concern whenever I go to some conventions. You know, there was a guy I met. He's kind of a makeup effects wizard who, you know, I wanted to grow up and be that guy when I was like 12 years old. And then I met him in real life, and I was like, oh, I can't really possibly idolize this guy ever again. Mm-hmm. But fortunately, I mean, most of the people I've met at horror cons are just, you know, lovely people, and everybody's usually super cool. And plus, those places are such great hangouts for, you know, for just horror fans. I mean, every time I walk into one, like a Horror Hound or, you know, something sort of Monster Mania, you know, when it got, I drove 9 hours away, you know, it's, you just sort of walk into that main hall, and, it's like, ah, oh, God, I'm home.
Yeah. I know. I have that same feeling, you know. I just love going, even if I'm not, you know, involved in any aspect, just walking around and, you know, looking at the stuff and just going, you know, God, where was this when I was 8 years old? I would have just died, you know. But I'm happy now looking at it. So it's not like, you know, that big of a regret. I'm just sort of happy I can still feel eight, you know, looking at it.
Me too. I'm such – even – you know, when there are some masks that are sort of super scary, or, you know, when there's a little table set up with like a, you know, kind of a torture porny horror flick that an indie filmmaker is trying to sell or something like that, I still feel like a kid. I still feel giddy around all of that stuff when I'm walking up and down the aisles and seeing so many people who are as in love with the genre as I am. So, yeah, it's always a blast. I can't wait until the next one. I think the next Horror Hound is going to be in 2 or 3 weeks, I think. So... yeah, I can't wait. I'm actually fortunate enough to this will be the first. Well, no, I guess the second con since. But I'm writing for the magazine version of Horror Hound now, which is kind of cool. And I can't wait to actually meet up with the guys who run the magazine and the con all together. Even though I fear I might take a lambasting a bit because I just turned in an article for them. It's a one pager where I and feel free to laugh because most people will. I completely understand. But I wrote a sort of in defense of piece for Blair Witch 2. Because wow. I genuinely dig that movie, and I also understand that I am one of the few. So so I basically wrote a piece explaining myself for, you know, they thought it would be fun to have sort of a Blair Witch article to coincide with the release of the new movie that comes out in mid-September, which is when the next magazine is going to hit. So I was like, you know, I always wanted to write a defense of Blair Witch 2, and I basically got the, okay, if you want to take the heat, go ahead and write it. But
yeah, I was fortunate that I saw Blair Witch at home, you know, I had like a little private, I made my own little movie screen, you know, with a, you know, kind of a classic Stewart screen, you know, silver screen in my living room. Oh, wow. and a projector and stuff. You know, it took me till 50 years of age before I finally, you know, had the wherewithal to be able to set that whole thing up. But, you know, somebody got me a bootleg, you know, VHS tape of it, and basically said, this is like the thing that's going around. You got to check this out. Watch it alone. And so it had a nice, you know, setup. So, you know, I closed, blacked out all the windows in the living room, you know, to watch this thing by myself. And I got to say, you know, I really enjoyed what they were doing. I really thought this is very cool to make you feel, you know, like you're seeing something that was real, and, you know, no blood and all just suspense. And, you know, I thought it was just great. And I couldn't wait to see it with a genre audience. And when it came out, you know, I went to like one of the local, you know, Cineplexes first day with the crowd, you know, which again is the only way I want to see horror movies is, you know, with the intended crowd on that first weekend, just to see, you know, does it work? You know, are they getting what they want? And I was shocked that people were talking through it, that they were texting, they were, you know, it was just amazing. That's like, why is this not engaging them? What did they expect? I don't know, but it's somehow for that crowd, you know, at least, and maybe there's other audiences that I've been at a different theater. Cause as I said before, audiences can be strange, you know, it would have been, you know, basically a disaster of a screening. But I went, no, I know what I saw, and I know there's something great. And, you know, it kind of went on to basically find its audience. But a few weeks later was when I'd mentioned, you know, that the Sixth Sense sneak preview happened. And that was the complete polar opposite in terms of an audience that was there with the movie. And, you know, but it didn't have any hype. We didn't know what we were going to see, which had a lot to do with it too. Blair Witch, there was a huge expectation factor with the internet buzz and stuff. So I don't know if this particular crowd just, you know, whoever were the alpha dogs in the crowd didn't connect, but it broke my heart that they were so disengaged, you know, with the experience. And, you know, it should have been really intense. And I saw just recently, what's the one that's the got one word title. It's like a period movie, and the daughter's possessed. They're like Puritans.
The Witch.
The Witch, yeah. There again, I saw that at a, you know, like 11 o'clock show on a Friday night, and basically a Hispanic audience, and most of them seemed like they were friends and whatnot, and you know, they were talking, and at a certain point, everybody shut up. And I went, wow, they're listening to this dialogue that's very flowery, you know, very unlike what they're used to listening to in movie dialogue. And, you know, they really got engaged. And then there was a point where they sort of disengaged and a couple got up and left. I went, okay, that's it. It's over. And then when the movie started to get more intense again, they were right there, you know, right till the end again, and brought them all back in. So it was, it's just so amazing to me to watch the dynamics of a crowd, and especially with horror, because it's so key to try to keep them focused, keep them, you know, there, you know, through the whole experience.
Yeah, I'm always kind of wary of, I mean, the best experience you can have watching a horror movie is watching it with a packed crowd who's actually there to, you know, if they're there for the movie. But if you even have one person who is, you know, they're paying more attention to their cell phone, or they have that bright little screen lit up, or if they're chanting dumb things back at the screen, it can completely kill that tension. But I was actually lucky. I count myself now, especially in hindsight. I mean, this was the days before like rampant cell phone use when Blair Witch came out. It was back in, was it mid 99? But the audience that I saw it at, was at the local theater here, the one that I wound up working at. It was in the largest house, the 385 screen or seat theater rather. And it was entirely sold out, all 385 seats. I was sitting in the middle. Wow. The movie begins and people are like chatting and like super energetic during all the previews. I think, you know, all of that year's big horror previews were probably attached to it. Like, God, what would have been back then? Like Stigmata and, you know, the Schwarzenegger movie, yeah. End of Days, and, you know, trailers like that. The moment the movie begins, yeah. And that white text goes up, you know, in October of 1994, three student filmmakers went missing, you know, all of that. From that point on until the end credits, silence. You could have heard a pin drop in a room full of people, not one word spoken, nothing of the sort. And at the very end, I'll never forget it, complete silence all the way through. You could feel that everybody was like super anxious and super intense. And it cuts to black after the camera hits the ground. And there's probably a beat of, what would you say, 3, 4, 5 seconds before you see that first credit come up written, you know, and directed by. Somebody to my right said, "Oh, my God." And then the entire audience burst out laughing. And it was one of the greatest film going experiences I've ever had. And I'm so glad it was with that movie, because I wound up, I love that original movie. And I can't wait to see what, you know, Adam Wingard has done with the newest film. I'm very curious to see what that's going to be.
But, yeah, me too. I'm just glad and the trailer looks great.
Oh, my God. Yeah, I think watched this interview with him on Bloody Disgusting, I think, where he noted, you know, if the first movie was more Alien, then he tried to make Aliens. You know, if the first film was about being lost in the woods, then the second movie is about just running away from you know, an entity or being chased by an entity through the woods. And it's like, okay, you know, I'm on board with that. I'm just glad the franchise is back, because, you know, looking at all the stuff that they came up with after that first movie, you know, the little mini docs that played on Sci-Fi and then Showtime, and, you know, the little extra bits that were released. And then, you know, the Blair Witch dossier, the book that ties into the movie as though it were real events. And then I think there were a couple of other books. Yeah. And, you know, they had such a rich mythology built within that first 90-minute movie. And then, you know, unfortunately, I mean, the one thing I can't defend the second movie from is, you know, charges that it pretty much killed the franchise, because it did that. You know, I mean, the first movie took in nearly $250 million worldwide.
Did it really? I didn't know that.
Yeah, it was like, wow. It was $147 on a $35,000 budget, bought for $1 million by Artisan. You know, it earned $147 million in the U.S. and $249 million worldwide. And a year later, the franchise was dead and has been for 16 years. That's just insane.
It is. Wow. Who's had the rights all this?
It was Lionsgate. Artisan, from what I was reading, it was kind of interesting. Apparently, Artisan was just this little company. They sort of got put on the map by Blair Witch, even though, I mean, they put up $1 million for Blair Witch, so they had to have had some money behind them even then. But Blair Witch came out. It was huge for them. And then they decided they wanted to build up the company as big as they could, as quickly as they could, so they could sell it off. And they thought Blair Witch 2 was going to do that for them. So even though Dan Myrick and Eduardo Sanchez told them they wanted to wait and not immediately sequelize it, and they had an idea for a prequel film about the witch, you know, in the 1700s, Artisan wanted a movie out by the following Halloween, and we got Blair Witch 2. And it didn't tank. They made the movie for $15 million, and it made 47 or 48 worldwide. But you know, it just it wasn't another monster like the first film was. So. And then they wound up selling off to Lionsgate not long after that. And I guess Lionsgate has just been sitting on the rights all these years. You know, that was the company that did horror in the mid-aughts too.
Yeah.
You know, they. Oh, yeah. So you would have thought, of all places, Lionsgate would have found a way to resurrect that. And I mean, they did eventually. It just, it feels like it was 10, 12, 14 years too late. So
yeah, there's so much that goes on behind those closed doors about, you know, whether we're going to do this, not do this, who's writing it. You know, I don't think that draft is right. Let's put somebody else on it. I mean, you know, and some of it just drags on and on, and then people get canned, and then the whole process stops. And, you know, it's just amazing. Anything gets made with the way the machinery just gets clogged up, just indecision and fear. And you know, the thing that I've said repeatedly in this about this business is, you know, the best answer for these people is no. You know, should we make this movie? No. You know, do you like the script? Nope. If you keep saying no, you will keep your job a lot longer than if you say yeah and that thing gets done and it doesn't work, you're out of a job. You know, who said yes to this? Joe. Okay. Get Joe off the clock. I mean, they, you know, they're always looking for somebody to blame. Somebody has to be the guy that made the wrong decision so that they can justify, you know, to whoever, you know, the investors or whatever, why this happened. You know, it wasn't me. It was, you know, this guy said it was good. So what does that mean? You know, it's like, well, let's get a proven title. You know, I mean, who would have thought that people wouldn't show up for an Exorcist TV show? Come on. You know how much money that thing made? You know, they're always looking for something, a star, you know, from the producers of so-and-so. I mean, something that they can grab onto, you know, that will help them justify why it's worth making this thing. And the public doesn't care. I mean, ultimately, it really is just a sales tool more than anything else. And, you know, people will say, who's in it? And it's like, oh, it's Nick Cage. It's like, oh, yeah, well, he was in that. Yeah, he's good. Well, you know, Nick Cage is in debt up to his ass from bad, you know, tax evasion and shit. So Nick's taking friggin' everything, you know, has been for years. You know, so you see him in all this stuff. You know, he's got stuff to pay off. And, you know, Marlon Brando, you know, when I met with him on a movie, you know, basically he had an island and God knows how many wives that he was paying alimony to. So, like, you know, if you give me $1 million a week, I'll be there. And I mean, and that was it. You know, he just wanted the money and he'd go in and tell you how he was going to do it. And then just before it was going to happen, he'd back away. You know, no, this is shit. I'm not going to do this. And it's funny how what really goes on is just crazy, you know. And as I said, how anything ever gets done or is any good is a miracle, you know.
Yeah, I mean, my God, watching that. Speaking of Brando, the documentary, is it Lost Souls? Maybe the making of Richard Stanley's Island of Dr. Moreau. It's just kind of heartbreaking.
Yeah.
To you know, oh, yeah. I like Stanley's work a lot, but I mean, there's so little that he's made. You know, there was that handful of documentaries, and then, you know, Dust Devil, which is fantastic, and Hardware, and then I think he did one little piece for the Theater Bazaar anthology a few years back. But you know, watching that documentary and getting a sense of what his vision was going to be for that movie, I think that movie would have been really something. I think it could have been incredible. But and not that, you know, I actually kind of like the movie as it exists, you know, the Frankenheimer version, but to hear all the tales about the making of the movie, it sounds like he was brought in to sort of guide a ship that had already set sail, you know, under the studio's flag. And but I think it's a well-made movie. I think it's an interesting movie. But you could tell that Stanley was going to tell a very personal version of that story. And I think it would have been kind of fantastic to see.
Yeah. I mean, it's funny because, you know, I'd see John at these blue ribbon committees with the DGA, you know, when we were voting on TV movies and miniseries and stuff. And the first time I saw him, you know, he would start talking about, you know, that movie, and all he did was, you know, I said, oh, so Brando must have been difficult. No, Val Kilmer, you know, and he just went into all these horror stories about Val Kilmer and stuff. So when I was going to work with Brando, I went to every director that I could reach and say, can you tell me what the experience, you know, was like? And of course, all of them said basically the same thing, which is, you know, run, don't walk, do not do this. You know, you think like, oh, we all did, you're going to have these great stories in the locker room to tell one day about, he said, but it's not worth it. He will destroy you. He hates directors, you know. And even Brando said to me, you know, other than, you know, what's his name? Ila Kazan, who was the only one that could direct. Well, everybody else is bullshit. And he literally would take directors on and find out stuff about them to put them down in front of everybody and things. And John, you know, I went back and I said, okay, you know, you didn't have a problem with Brando. I never said that. I said that Val Kilmer was weird. Brando was horrible, you know, and then going to hear all, you know. But, you know, yeah, that I've never seen that documentary. I would, you know, I'd love to see that.
Oh, it's excellent. I think it's on Blu-ray now. I caught it when it was on VOD. I think it was about a year ago. I have to imagine it's on home video by now. But yeah, if you get the chance to watch it, it's fascinating and heartbreaking, and it's one of my favorite film documentaries like that, you know, and my favorite types are usually of the movies that could have been, you know. I'm thinking about not just that, but, you know, Jodorowsky's Dune is another incredible one.
Oh, yeah. Which, yeah. That is great. I mean, my favorite for years has been, you know, Eleanor Coppola's, you know, Hearts of Darkness.
Oh, my God, yeah.
This watching, and again, back to Brando, you know, you watch Francis go through, you know, hurricanes and heart attacks and all this shit, and it was Brando is the thing that gave him the mental breakdown, because everything else you can kind of go, all right, what can we do, but when you sit there with another human being and trying to get them to change their mind about something, and the whole crew sitting around where they're up on a hill discussing, you know, Colonel Kirk's. I mean, that's what, you know, drove him crazy, you know, having met Brando, I could see how that would be, especially if, you know, he had something in his head that was just insane. And Francis is trying to save this movie of his that was so, you know, monumental, you know, and been so difficult up to then. Yeah, it's he, you know, but there's God, who's that actor who did or director that did American X?
Is it Tony Kaye, I think?
Yes. Good. He I guess did some Brando did some acting class, taught some acting classes. And I guess Tony shot these acting classes of Brando teaching actors. They exist somewhere. I don't know who's got the rights or what's gone on with it, but I've been dying to see that, because that has got to be fucking incredible.
Yeah, my God. Imagine just stringing those together and releasing them as is. That would be amazing.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, Brando was, no question, a genius and a madman. I mean, following his train of thought, you know, I was there with him like 3 hours, and it was like nothing I'd ever experienced before. And of course, I kept, you know, sort of pinching myself going, I'm talking to the Godfather and Colonel Kirk's here, you know, and this legend, you know, and he's this, you know, huge, powerful character that's part little boy, very mischievous, very smart, and couldn't start to answer a question, veer off into 20 different subjects, and then come back and answer that question that you first asked. I mean, it was fascinating. Fascinating experience.
I have to ask, I had to digress too much, but you mentioned Silence of the Lambs winning Best Picture, and I love that movie, but it's amazing how many people insist that that movie isn't a horror film. And I was wondering what your opinion on it was, because it almost seems like there's a certain type of audience member that wants to love that movie but not admit that they dearly love what is essentially a genre flick, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's that one's a little harder for me, at least, to label as a horror movie. It certainly has so many horrific elements to it, and there's certainly a great thriller aspect to it, and a very smart, dramatic battle of wits, you know, between Jodie and Hopkins' character. That, you know, those scenes just played out, you know, in a frighteningly tense, suspenseful way. And I mean, Jonathan Demme hit so many great notes in that movie. And the fact that, you know, his style is that, you know, staring the other, you know, actors looking at the other actor literally right off the mat box, you know, so it looks like they're looking at you, you know, when they cut back and forth. So it's that, you know, he makes you somehow confront these characters in his style, and working it into that particular kind of mix of genres, you know, definitely, I see exactly how somebody could say, well, that really is horrific. I mean, that that scared me. And yet we're happy when he walks away at the end because we also loved him,
sure.
You know, because he was so damn entertaining. And that guy that, you know, abused him, you know, we were more than happy to see him, you know, get killed. But, you know, there was so much just good storytelling, you know, and cinematically and surprises and, you know, definitely putting somebody's skin over your face and stuff like that. You know, you would not see that in anything other than a horror movie. So, you know, it's very hard to say it doesn't fall into that or those aren't the things that you remember more than anything else. But for me, that movie, again, gets back to, you know, two characters that are just unforgettable. And, you know, there's just no getting around that what Hannibal was as a iconic, you know, villain is something that, you know, everybody imitates, you know, in some way. You know, get that Hannibal, you know, that stare, get that cold, get that, you know, get that Lecter kind of thing going. You know, it just is something that's a quality that, you know, actors talk about all the time, or writers say, yeah, it's got to be like a Hannibal Lecter kind of guy. You know, it's an amazing creation.
So you would say you're definitely more interested in just staying sort of in the feature realm at the moment?
Pretty much. I mean, in the thing I'm really interested in is virtual reality. I've been keeping track of that over the last couple of years and watching some of the, you know, incredible things, especially in horror, that can be done, that is, you know, taking us one more step into something that is so much more experiential, you know, than just, you know, watching a movie, you know, to be able to trigger somebody to look to the left or right because of a sound effect. And then you turn and suddenly there's something in your face, or you see something that gives you a bit of information that you keep going. And the whole notion that, you know, we're going to have to change the very art of filmmaking, that forget close-ups and two shots and over the shoulder and all that. Everything is basically, you know, that voyeuristic, you know, one camera following and things that make you feel like you are, you know, like you would in a game. You know, you may choose to go through a door and you're going to get one movie or experience going that way. And the next time you do it, you can go through another door or turn around and go upstairs, or, you know, there's so many different variations that could happen. And there's just so many things to explore in terms of what will affect you emotionally. You know, I've had some of those things on where they do like a, you know, a camera crane up, and you just feel your whole body going, you know, like up in the air, like it takes your breath away, you know, and for some people it, you know, gets them physically nauseated. Other people doesn't bother them at all. And luckily I'm in that camp, but I just went, wow. I mean, you were not going anywhere, but it just felt like I just rose up, you know, into the clouds or over the mountain or, you know, wherever the filmmaker wanted to take me. But it really doesn't work to cut, you know, and go from thing to thing. It jars you in a way that takes you out of the experience of a voyeur following somebody or standing back and watching it. And the more movies that we've seen of recent that have the Steadicam shots that do the entire scene, I mean, that's really preparing us for that way of seeing a movie, you know, purely by somebody that keeps wrapping around, and you stage it in a way that it's really entertaining and unique. And you are there, part of the experience, but not seen, which I think there's a lot to be mined out of that. You know, in fact, with all the genres, whether it's comedy or horror or suspense.
Now, do you see virtual reality working as a theatrical experience, or do you think that would only have to be a sort of home entertainment thing?
Well, you know, we talked about that, the DGA, was it last year? I think it was, when there was a big virtual reality seminar, and there was a lot of arguing, you know, the old guard. It's like, oh, wait a minute, you know, people are all going to sit with that, to cock the thing on their head, and, you know, you're sitting next to somebody, but, you know, and they go, you know, you're still going to feel each other, you know, in the room. There is an experience that's sort of to be had there. A lot of rides are doing that now. You know, you go on, you know, Star Tours and you're given 3D glasses, you know, or some of the other rides at Universal. So already, you know, they're sort of setting up for that. You're wearing something so you can see the effects, and you're less aware of the people around you. but you feel them. But the thing that they brought up, which I thought was really interesting, is that, you know, I don't know how long it's going to take for things to go feature length. You know, it may be 20 minutes, or it's almost like the way movies started with the Nickelodeon. So you put a, you know, a penny in or a dime in, and you crank this thing, and that's the movie. And then they, you know, become shorts, and then eventually a little longer, and then eventually, you know, obviously D.W. Griffith got credited with, you know, Birth of a Nation being like the first big theatrical feature, but I'm sure other countries, you know, were doing the same thing at the same time, and that he was ours. That eventually we'll find some way to evolve this into, you know, more spectacular. But what they were pointing out was that if we're doing these things in like half hour things, and it's more like a ride experience thing, that, you know, you watch this, and then when it's over and you take this thing off, you turn to the person you're with and it's like, can you believe that? No. Did you go through that door? No. What door? You know, the one is like, oh shit, I got to do this again. It's like, I'm telling you, dude, you got to do it. You got to do this. You're not going to believe what happened. Yeah. But did you go down there? I did. Was that not incredible? You know, so you're like, you'd be sharing afterwards what you saw, you know, and did you do this? Did you do that? Which is, again, very different experience. It's not what we're used to. And I don't know. I mean, it's sort of exciting to me because it's like, you know, it's like when somebody tells you you got to go see a movie, and that's the reason you go see the movie. Like I said, why I went to see The Exorcist. You know, it's always gets back to that. Somebody says to you, you know me, you know I hate everything. You got to see this, you know, and it's like, okay, I'm in. So if you're able to do that, you know, after an experience that's a virtual reality thing, and you feel everybody buzzing, I think the want to see it again would be pretty strong. And that's really where the money is ultimately in a business. It's like, not the first time you see something. It's, do you go back again? Do you recommend other people to go back? You got to see this, you know, which is why there's always, you know, huge lines at the amusement parks for the rides that are the super cool rides. You know, they'll stand in the sun for 2 hours to go on this 4-minute ride because they heard it's really great. And we're kind of borrowing from, I think, that when we start to get into the virtual reality thing. And then if the seats buzz or move, or, you know, mist goes into your face, or some of the other things that, you know, they're doing now to make it much more experiential, you know, it's somewhere in all that. And who knows, you know, where it will land, and then how fast technology goes in digital, you know, things will just keep evolving, you know, faster than we can keep up with it. But I find that all very exciting, because I think, especially for a young creative person that wants to do something new, you know, there's so many great choices of things that you can explore, and, you know, give us something that once again will scare us like The Exorcist did, or, you know, make us feel warm and wonderful like E.T. did in its day, and, you know, and go down the line with things. I just saw the Jason Bourne movie, and there's a chase down Las Vegas Boulevard, and, you know, you go, all right, you know, they didn't really do everything that you see them doing, but it was so well executed, you know, so, you know, top of the line, everything with the crashes, with the CGI that they did do, with the stunts, with the cutting, everything that you go, you know, I wanted to believe that was real because it was just so well done. And it was an insane idea, you know, like having to chase through Times Square. It's like, how the hell can you do that? And, you know, Las Vegas Boulevard is just like that. Bumper to bumper traffic all the time. How the hell did they do a high speed chase and go over cars and go over stuff and go into the casino? And I loved it. You know, the guys in the band that went with me to see it were going, oh yeah, it was a cool popcorn movie. And I go, it was a cool popcorn. I go, yeah, all right, it was, but can you not admit that was friggin' amazing? You know, I mean, that's just the guys that they pulled off that, to me, I was in awe, because it's something that I never saw before. And, you know, I'm sure people have talked about, wouldn't that be great if we could do that? And then, well, they did it. You know, they had the money and the wherewithal to pull off something that spectacular.
You know, I got to say, just because of the nature of this conversation, I now really, really want to see a virtual reality version of an exorcism. Either standing in the room as the two priests do their thing. Maybe you could be the person possessed. Maybe you could be the person actually performing the exorcism. But I think it could be pretty amazing.
Yeah. Well, I saw this one thing called, I think the name is Catatonic, if I'm remembering correctly. And it's like a 8-minute, maybe short little horror movie. And the way they had it set up, which was great at the Directors Guild Theater, is they had two old school nurses in old school nurses' outfits standing, holding wheelchairs. And, you know, we all had to line up and wait our turn. And, you know, and you got to watch people going through it, which was also fun. It's just standing there and watching people freak out and their arms jump and all this stuff. And basically what it was is, you know, you sit in this thing and they put the virtual reality thing on your head and your ears and things. And then you hold on to the wheelchair. And, you know, when the thing starts, it's like you're watching from the point of view of sitting in a wheelchair, and you can look down and see the hands. You can turn around and see the nurse behind you in the shadows, the way they shot the thing. And it was like in a insane asylum. So basically all it was is traveling down these halls, downstairs, through doors, all this stuff. And, you know, these crazy, insane characters would suddenly just spring into your face, or you'd see them all the way at the end. And so now you're heading towards them. And then suddenly one would come out from the right, you know, and just, you know, scare the hell out of you. And, you know, and then you'd come to a room and, you know, and the wheelchair would bang up against the door trying to like get in. And then, you know, you'd feel this pull back and go through it. I mean, it just really was this, you know, like a fun house, except, you know, it was all virtual reality. And I, you know, and it was a lot of fun. And watching the people react to this thing, you know, was a hoot. I mean, you could hardly wait to go through it, just watching everybody else do it. But as I said, you know, 8 minutes really wasn't a story, but it certainly was, you know, a fun ride.
I'm sold. I can't wait until somebody harnesses that and, you know, brings it into the feature realm. I think it could be pretty amazing. Are you actually on tour at any point with the Sloths, or are there plans for upcoming tours?
Yeah, actually, we just are, you know, finishing up some. It's right now. It's just a, basically West Coast and Northwest and Vancouver and San Diego. Sort of like San Diego. I think we're going to like Phoenix, you know, Arizona, New Mexico area. But yeah, we keep trying to get to the East Coast. I mean, we got as far as New Orleans, and then we went and did Spain for like a Purple Weekend, which was a garage rock festival that they did and that they had us over in Spain for. But I really want to get on the East Coast and, you know, middle America. And the music that we're doing that's on the album and stuff is very, you know, classic 60s rock and roll, exactly the stuff that, you know, we were into at that time. And, you know, there's a fan base that, you know, loves that early garage rock, of which, you know, we were a garage band solely because our parents wouldn't let us play in the house. We had to play in the garage. And, you know, at that time it was looked upon as, boy, you guys are really, you know, losers. It, you know, you can't even rent a studio to practice in. It's like, yeah, well, you know, we're a garage band. You know, now it's kind of a cool term, you know, meaning, you know, things are rough and edgy and, you know, not always in tune. And, you know, what eventually, you know, the Ramones got down to a fine art, you know, is what we were all sort of playing with, you know, in the mid 60s and calling it rebel rock instead of punk. You know, it was our, you know, our way of kind of going, all right, we're going to take what we've learned from the Stones and all those great English groups and what they had learned from the great blues and rhythm and blues artists of America and kind of make it our own teenage angst and, you know, always about girls and getting out of school and rock and roll.
Thank you so much for doing this. It's very much appreciated.
Thank you so much. It was really a joy, you know, talking with you.